This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay. Okay, I'd like to welcome all of you, colleagues, students, visitors, friends, Scarlett, for coming. Today we have a very special writer, and I'd like to begin introducing him by saying, try this. Ask the person that you are in love with to analyze you, and you will get a lengthy response. Ask the person you're in love with to critique you, and you will get a lengthy response. Ask the person you're in love with the simple question, how do you feel? Simple question, how do you feel? And you will get a pause, silence you. It is in this realm of feelings, of emotion, of honesty, where fiction resides and communicates. Like poetry, fiction cannot hide between big, arrogant blocks of language. It is simple, it is elegant, and it is as complex as I love you. Today with us, we have Stuart Onnett, whose prose I find to be elegant, simple, and yet tackle some of the most complex of emotions. A Prayer for the Dying is a novel where the reader will not be the same afterwards. It makes one question, what is duty? What is responsibility? What is necessity? Where does one draw the line between profession and family? What is fate, God, death? These are difficult questions, and Stuart Onnett handles them with a simple, elegant lyricism. Like in this scene I'm about to read to you, about when the protagonist is going to put down a plague-infested cow. Stuart writes, you raise the barrel, sight on her eyes, the black pupil a target. A breeze floats through the shadows and across her face. You don't feel it now, but later you'll know, and you'll see this as merciful. Now you're not sure. It's responsibility, not choice, but you do. More for yourself, you think. This hesitation is a luxury in another person or another soul's pain. You shrug the thought off, still clinging to some dream of innocence, some dream of blamelessness, even as you release it. A Prayer for the Dying is a book that changes the reader. It's a book that speaks to the heart and soul, and it can frighten us. Like Cynthia Osick's The Shawl, it is a book where serious writing students have come up to me and said, why did you make us read that? It has effed me up. And that is a good thing, for it highlights the best of fiction, transcendence. I've read on the internet that it's no wonder that some have compared A Prayer for the Dying to Camus' The Plague. After all, like Camus, Stuart Onnett's prose is economically concise as it takes on serious issues. I've also read that, though gracious for the comparison, Stuart Onnett responded by saying that he's more of a horror writer and that his book owes more to George C. Romero's horror film Night of the Living Dead or Plants vs. Zombies or something in that vein. And I found this quote not so much as humorous as to be honest and modest, a certain humility in Stuart for many writers like myself who kill to be compared to Camus. That is Stuart's humility. I have some anecdotes to share with you. During his days as a student in the MFA program, I was not around. But when Susan Choi, a classmate of Stuart, offered a reading here, she said about Stuart, and I paraphrase, she said that she was scared of Stuart at first. She was scared of Stuart because he was older and had a wife. But what really scared her was that Stuart had a vision to what type of writer he wanted to be. And she said, none of us had that vision. And then she said, when I got to know him, I realized he was very kind and gracious. Another MFA graduate during Stuart's time here, Juno Diaz, said that that Stuart was known as Dr. No because he was very hard on workshops and missions. And therefore he pushed me. He pushed me to always submit only my very best. Otherwise, Dr. No would rightfully shred me to pieces. A very gracious man, from someone who wrote a Catholic existentialist book as a prayer for the dying, a wonderful, scary, chilling, simple, and yet complex novel. Anyway, without any further gossip, I'd like to thank the anonymous donors, my colleagues and students, once again, for attending, and it is my honor to introduce to you a writer who will communicate with us without hiding anything within parentheses, without endless colons and billions of suffixes and prefixes, but will use a simple, elegant, and complex language, like I love you, Stuart Onan.
Thank you. I have not lost my memory. I mean, I'm getting older, but uni was not in my workshop. So he's a storyteller, I guess. A Prayer for the Dying, when I look back at it, it's kind of not the product of a sane mind. It reminds me of The Speed Queen, too. I look back at both of those books where I got a little bit too close to my first and second person protagonists and kind of just went for the ride, the little spiral downward with them. And I remember after I finished the book, I felt really, really good to be done and sort of away from that person there. My wife remembers me. We were driving along in a car, and I was like, wow, it's so beautiful out here. And it's just like your usual crappy day in upstate New York. And she's like, no, it's not. I was like, well, now I'm finally seeing through my eyes instead of through theirs. So I'd sort of gotten rid of that person that I was for about a year, which is kind of creepy, I think. I remember reading Paul Cody's great first novel, The Stolen Child. And after reading it, I mean, it's a really, really chilling book. It's a terrifying book. And afterwards, seeing him in a completely different light, looking at him like as if he were sort of the hidden serial killer that's in the book. And I kind of wanted to write a book that made people look at me in a different way. And I got a little too close, I think. And after that wonderful introduction, now I'm going to read some rather clotted prose, a much heavier line that I've been working with in the last few years, with parenthetical comments and dashes and all sorts of crap in it. I never stay the same. I have a very short attention span. This is a book called Emily Alone is Coming Out St. Patrick's Day, which I don't think is racist. At least my publishers don't think it's racist, so I guess it is, being an Onan. Emily is from an earlier book, Wish You Were Here, which was a big family saga, and originally it was going to be just about her. And as I was writing that book, I suddenly became fascinated by all the other characters, and so everybody got a turn. There were 14 different narrators in the book. And so years later, I felt that I still had sort of unfinished business with Emily. So this is about her living alone. She's 78 years old. She's a widow, and her husband Henry died about 8 years ago. And Henry, on his deathbed, told Emily to take care of his sister, Arlene, the sister-in-law. And on his deathbed, he also told Arlene to take care of Emily. And they don't like each other at all. So they're together a lot in this book. Well, not so much in these sections. I open up with a quote from Virginia Woolf. Could it be, even for elderly people, that this was life, startling, unexpected, unknown? And for this first section, what do you need to know here? Emily came from a small town in central Pennsylvania called Kersey, a very sort of a dumpy town. and went to Pittsburgh for school and married up. So Arlene and Henry come from a little bit of money. They come from the comfort of the middle class in Pittsburgh of the time, the late 50s or mid 50s. I think that's all you need to know for this. Oh, WQED is the NPR station in Pittsburgh, plays classical music. This is called Family Pictures. Emily thought it was not morbid, but absolutely natural that as she grew closer to her own end, she became more and more interested in her origins and wanted to pass that knowledge on to her children. Her mother and father had come from clans whose roots traced the valleys of north central Pennsylvania, linking towns like Kersey and Ridgeway and St. Mary's. The Waite and Benton men were farmers and loggers and miners at first, and only later tradesmen and merchants, the women generally housewives, along with a few unmarried Sunday school teachers and missionary aunts. Her own father had worked as a building inspector for the county, while her mother taught kindergarten and first grade. They had struggled to achieve and maintain their middle-class respectability in the face of a depression and a world war, a feat Emily thought was lost on her own children, accustomed to an affluence that must have seemed their birthright, as much it had been Henry's and Arlene's, born to good fortune. As if to remind them of her own humble beginnings, every Christmas Emily gave Kenneth and Margaret a framed picture of another forgotten branch of the family, and if these gifts were initially met with indifference, that was fine. Emily had conceived of this as a long-term project, one that might take their entire lives to finally resonate, as it had with her. She'd come to appreciate her Kersey upbringing only well after she'd fled the town and made the long-wished-for transformation into a fashionable city dweller. Not that her teenaged estimation of the place had been wrong. It was even worse now, a dying Appalachian backwater. But looking back, she saw that, like Margaret, she'd been an ungrateful child, stubborn and arrogant to no real purpose beyond her own vanity. At the dining room table, as she scavenged through her mother's loose black and white snapshots with their quaintly pinked edges, the month and year neatly machine-stamped in all four margins, she found photos of herself standing with her arms crossed on a dock, or leaning against their Plymouth, or sitting on their back steps eating an apple, always with a slightly fiery scowl, as if she'd specifically asked not to have her picture taken. As a child, she'd been emotional, a crier, a brooder, a showy thrower of tantrums. Once she'd begun, she could not be appeased. Why, her mother pleaded, did she have to be this way? There was no good answer. It was just the way she was, difficult, touchy, mean. Her relatives blamed it on her being an only child, spoiled from too much attention. Her father tried to turn it into a joke. Little Miss Moody Patootie, don't look at her cross-eyed. Wait till you have kids of your own, her mother threatened, as if Emily would pass her temper on like a disease of the blood, until, inevitably, she did. And oh, it was rich. There was no end of the I told you so's. She remembered many times trying to coax Margaret and Kenneth to smile, Kenneth, who had Henry's sweet nature, but followed his big sister's lead, so as not to ruin a group portrait, so as not to embarrass her. Those were here as well, the prime of their family life carefully documented in album after album, an editing job put off until the children had left, then attacked with commemorative devotion. The patent falseness of so many shots staged to mark an occasion only deepened the mystery of the past, its unhappiness dressed up, hidden, invisible to the camera. Often, as she leafed through the sticky, plastic-coated pages, spotting herself with a frizzy perm or wearing a loud printed blouse, she was struck by how long life was and how much time had passed and how she wished she could go back and apologize to those closest to her, explain that she understood now. Impossible. And yet the urge to return and be a different person never lessened, grew only more acute. Yes, Henry was a saint and a martyr at his most passive. But how did her mother and father ever put up with her? How did she not strangle Margaret? It was easier to revisit people she didn't remember. Her mother had done the hard part, tracking down the names and writing them on the back, along with a date where available, and a note making clear their relation. To cover as much ground as possible, Emily chose only those pictures that showed a whole family. Last Christmas, she'd given them her great-great-grandfather and grandmother Benton and their four children squinting in front of a ramshackle farmhouse, along with their hired man, all of them in their Sunday best, the men with hats in hand. Following her scheme, this year's would be a studio portrait of her great-great-grandfather and grandmother Waite and their three girls from 1872. The flash bleached the girls' dresses, their faces pasty and shadowless, the baby, Lily, turned to the side, unsure. The Waite branch of the family was the more prosperous, which was obvious from the fact that they could afford this portrait. But of them individually, Emily knew little. John William Waite was a Cooper. Kathleen Gamble Waite would outlive him and two of their children, leaving only the middle girl, Helen, to mourn her. Emily tried to imagine inhabiting their world, and as she peered into their faces, straining to feel some connection, she wondered at how, 100 years from now, some descendant of hers would search her face, hoping to intuit her life and times, and realize the futility of her mission. Why should Margaret and Kenneth care about these strangers? They were all doomed to be mere emblems to those who didn't know them. And to those who did? The question of how she would be remembered was not one she wanted to contemplate. Her life had been happy, for the most part, her disappointments mild, common. Yet when she recalled herself, she did so with a mix of self-righteousness and shame, holding up her worst moments against her best intentions. She would never forget the name she'd flung at Henry in her rages, or the time she'd made her mother cry. She came from a place and a generation that didn't believe, as Margaret and Kenneth did, that you could or should forgive your own sins. She'd already found the picture she wanted, and as if to cut off her thoughts, she boxed up the rest and lugged them back down to their place in the basement. Here, in the dingy corner behind the furnace, where seepage darkened the wall of the foundation, rested their history. She'd spent countless hours sorting the pictures, mementos, into stackable Rubbermaid bins, each neatly labeled, and still there was so much more to do. She pulled the string of the bare bulb, and it all disappeared. Rufus was waiting for her at the top of the stairs, wagging his tail. "Who wants to go for a car ride?" she asked, making him twirl. But even after dropping the photo off at the Rite Aid to be copied, she couldn't shake her mood. She ended up going to bed early, reading Henry's Bible while the Chicago Symphony mauled Shostakovich. She marked her place and listened in the dark for a while, the Kohl's Christmas lights blinking, tinting the ceiling. It was ridiculous how, with no one's help, she'd worked herself into a perfect state. There was no reason, either. The past was the past. Better to work on the present instead of wallowing. And yet, the one comforting thought was also the most infuriating. Time, which had her on the rack, would just as effortlessly rescue her. This funk was temporary. Tomorrow, she would be fine. Spooky. Terrifying. This next section, you need to know Louise, and Louise Pickering was Emily's best friend. And sort of spent a lot of time with her after Henry died. And just recently, Louise has died. And now, Emily is basically the last survivor of the old gang in their neighborhood. On their street, she's the very last one left. So she has this very nostalgic feel for the times they used to be together. There's a detail in here. A Hamilton is an older style of American wristwatch, which was sort of highly prized back in the 20s and 30s. And this is called Christmas Cheer. With Margaret coming, the question was what to do with the booze. Out of respect for her sobriety, Emily's instinct was to stow it in the basement, not locked away, but boxed and out of sight. Except Margaret might take the empty liquor cabinet as an insult. Would it be better to pretend everything was fine? She'd tried that the last time. Fool me once. Except Margaret hadn't fooled anyone in years, not even herself. Emily felt equally helpless. Either way, Margaret could fault her, and after much agonizing, she decided to go with her first instinct. Until she filled two heavy boxes and lugged them downstairs, barely making a dent, she hadn't realized how much there was, Not just Henry's collection of scotches and the normal Episcopalian assortment of hard stuff, but the brandies and ports and sherries and different liqueurs they'd amassed over the years, many of them presents, some, like the cone-shaped bottle of Pear William and the dark rum from Kenneth and Lisa's Caribbean trip, untouched. The bottom shelf was like their basement, packed with forgotten odds and ends. They had two open bottles of Drambuie and two of her favorite Grand Marnier left over from the days when they used to entertain. Cointreau, Armagnac, Amaretto, B&B, Calvados. Though recently she'd apologized for blaming others for her own personal choices, in the past, Margaret often said it was no wonder she drank, given her role models. Emily had never taken this accusation to heart, since neither she nor Henry were what she would call heavy drinkers. Yes, they drank socially when they were younger. When Emily recalled their parties, she remembered the backyard flickering with tiki torches and Henry tending the barbecue, card tables laden with baked beans and potato salad and slices of watermelon and brownies, the whole neighborhood gathered, kids and adults both, for a good time. There would be croquet and horseshoes, and the boys would organize a wiffle ball game in the courtyard, drafting Henry to pitch. Maybe later Kay Miller would get out of hand and topple her lawn chair, or Jean Alford would break into song, but by then, the children were in bed. It was possible that Margaret watched them from her window, her nose pressed against the screen, but what she would have seen wasn't some depraved bacchanal, just a circle of friends trading stories and laughing, glad to have one another's easy company at the end of the night. It wasn't until Margaret was a teenager that they started having problems with kids stealing beers from the coolers. And it was to Emily's eternal shame that, under her relentless questioning, Kenneth confessed that Margaret was the culprit. Emily had let her off easy, though it was the late 60s and there were far worse things girls her age were into. No one could say that Emily had ignored the problem. If anything, she was too vigilant, and this was just the beginning. From then on, the two of them waged a daily struggle over clothes and boys and grades and smoking until, to the relief of everyone, Margaret went off to college, leaving the much easier, eager-to-please Kenneth, whose vices and desires were transparent. They'd had their flare-ups, yet at their very worst, which had not been often, she'd felt disdain from him, never hatred. She'd thought about this a great deal, having directed at the same time that same obliterating anger toward her own mother. At some point, maybe when she'd fled Kersey and left that stultifying world behind, or when she began a family of her own, she'd been able to put it aside. She feared that Margaret hadn't, and that she, through no fault of her own besides her existence, was somehow behind all of Margaret's problems. Louise said she would drive herself crazy trying to figure out why Margaret was the way she was, knowing it wasn't in Emily's nature to let even the smallest matter drop. She had tried. She had compromised, listened, waited, prayed. She'd lent her money, tens of thousands, foolishly perhaps, though she could rationalize it, saying she'd done it for the children. Looking back, it was hard to say if her efforts had succeeded. Was Sarah happy on her own in Chicago, as Margaret claimed? Was Justin really enjoying school? Emily had no way of knowing. She couldn't even be sure Margaret was sober, though that was the assumption they were working under. After all this, Emily thought, she'd better be. Was she being uncharitable? Overwrought? Why did the mere idea of Margaret's arrival set her off? Shouldn't she just be happy she was coming? The shame of it was that this was the best time of year to linger at the table and savor a wee dram, as Henry put it. Christmas meant the foamy, sweet kick of eggnog, and her grandmother waits breathtaking rum balls. She would have liked to offer Sarah wine with dinner now that she was of age, but that too was ruined. She didn't bother with the mixers or the glasses. The last box was a grab bag of half pints and miniatures and Henry's many flasks, all of which, to her dismay, needed polishing. She lugged it down, careful on the stairs, and set it atop the others beside his bench. She couldn't resist counting them, 8 full boxes of liquor. Stacked like seized evidence, they seemed to support Margaret's case, but Emily knew better. This accumulation had taken decades, and while she still enjoyed an occasional nip, most of these bottles would survive her. Not that that was any great loss. Henry would want Kenneth to have his scotch. The rest held no such sentimental value. In the top box rested a curved hip flash she'd given Henry for Christmas years ago, engraved with his initials. She lifted it out and angled it toward the light to admire the filigree. Slim as a cigarette case, it fit perfectly in the back pocket of his favorite corduroys. He carried it on their fall walks in the park and while he tinkered in the garage at Chautauqua. Winter nights in Panther Hollow, as they sat by the bonfire of broken-down pallets and watched the children skating where they'd once courted, he handed it to her first and then pretended to disinfect the mouth with his sleeve. Weekends and vacations, at the end of the day, he set it with his Hamilton on his dresser, another elegant accessory. That was what alcohol was to her, an extra civilized pleasure, part of the sophisticated life she'd always wanted. She understood that Margaret had a disease. What she couldn't figure out was why. She unscrewed the cap and passed the threaded stem under her nose, taking in the scent of old smoke, knowing she shouldn't, then tipped it to her lips. The scotch was dank and peppery with a sting of iodine. She held the sip, letting it puddle on her tongue a moment before swallowing, muttering its progress down her throat to her stomach. The warmth rose from her core, straight to her face, a flush like the first stirrings of a hot flash. Just a taste, that was all she wanted. She capped the flask, returned it to the box, and closed the flaps. After a brief search, she covered the stack with a drop cloth, still too conspicuous, but the best she could do. Was it enough? Probably not. But if Margaret wanted a drink that bad, at least she'd have to look for it. Later, her back hurt, and she had to lie down with a heating pad. She set her glasses on her nightstand, slung one arm over her eyes, and as she expected, drifted off to sleep. When she woke up, it was dark, and she was sweating. Some obnoxious Rachmaninoff was playing, meeting QED was in their evening schedule. She swung her legs off the bed and sat on the edge for a second, rubbing her face, and then laughed, thinking, "The things you do for your children." This last and third piece, you need to know that Margaret never finished her schooling there, and Sam, one of the grandchildren who's Kenneth's son, is having difficulties right now. He's kind of flunking out of college, or has flunked out of college, sort of left in mid-semester. Also, Margaret was heavy as a child and very unhappy, and it's been a very, very, you know, sort of lifelong argument between Margaret and Emily about whose fault that was there. Also that Emily's relationship with Kenneth's wife Lisa is very, very rocky and has been always there. This section's called Love, Emily. She didn't want anything for Mother's Day other than her children's happiness. The arrangement Kenneth sent was nice. Emily set it on the coffee table, where Rufus sniffed the pink asters as if they might be edible, but meant less to her than his call. She didn't have to wait for it. Like every Sunday, she'd come back from coffee hour and was plowing through the Times when the phone rang. His reliability was a gift in itself, and if his eagerness to please could make him timid and distant when he felt he'd failed, he was also like his father, and that he would never purposely hurt anyone, a trait Emily, not blessed with an even temperament, respected and envied. "Happy Mother's Day, Mom." "Now it is." She thanked him for the flowers. "Not my doing. Still, they're very nice. So, what's new in New England?" "Not a lot. Everyone was doing okay." After much discussion, Sam was registering for summer semester. "That's wonderful," Emily said. "We'll see." "You don't sound convinced." "I don't know how to say this. He and school just don't mix." "I gather, but what's the alternative?" "Exactly." "All you can do is keep encouraging him. I'd love for Margaret to talk to him." "It's an idea," he said, one of Henry's favorite evasions. "In any case, please tell him I'm rooting for him." "Oh, I will." From there, they branched off to more general topics, giving her a chance to share how tired she was of the election and the desperate state of the world. He'd have to ask Arlene about the pirates. She was done with their shenanigans. The weather was wet. Her garden was coming along. Rufus was still hanging in there. The Millers was still for sale. As always, she felt she had no news to report, as if her life had reached a kind of stasis. "All righty," he said, and I love you, Mom, and happy Mother's Day again before saying goodbye. She'd turned down the stereo to talk, and when she set the phone back in its charger, the house went quiet around her. Margaret would call when she called. Emily had learned long ago there was no profit in trying to anticipate her, and dialed up the volume again and went back to the art section. She found herself fretting about Sam and then about Sarah, who'd lost her job in Chicago. The worst thing in the world for Sarah would be to move back in with Margaret, for both of them. And Emily wondered if she should offer to help or whether, like so many of her overtures, it would be taken the wrong way. As a mother, she couldn't say she'd done her best with Margaret, but she'd try beyond the point where others might have reasonably given up. Henry had, worn down by the cycle of promises that turned out to be lies, the brief clean periods between treatment and relapse, the lost jobs, the credit card debt. Though she understood it perfectly, his withdrawal from their daughter was perhaps the greatest sorrow in Emily's life. Through everything, she'd always included Margaret in their plans, knowing often in those terrible years that her invitations would be ignored or flatly refused, and when accepted, the results would be disastrous. For Emily, Margaret's absence was a sadness, for the rest of the family, a relief. Kenneth, like Henry, was embarrassed by her, as were Sarah and Justin, who seemed to have taken her cautionary example to heart, feeding themselves and getting good grades so they could escape to a more orderly life. But that was the past, Margaret insisted. She'd been sober nearly 4 years now. She liked to talk about a clean slate, and in some ways their relationship had changed, but in others it felt like the same struggle they'd waged since Margaret turned 13. While she was more open and affectionate, showily at times, as if in her gratitude she could no longer control her emotions, Emily suspected it wasn't entirely genuine. Likewise, her constant references to making amends and surrendering to a higher power, when more than anything, Emily wanted her to take responsibility for her life, past and present. The money troubles, the parade of boyfriends, the inability to follow through on all but the most immediate plans, these were the same problems that had plagued Margaret forever. Dismayed at the arc of her thoughts today, of all days, she folded the paper and took her cup and saucer to the kitchen for a refill. Gazing out the back door at the dripping trees as she waited for the kettle to warm, she wondered at the whole chain of continuity running back through her mother to her grandmother Benton before her and down through Margaret to Sarah. Had her mother been as unhappy with her? Because they battled just as often and hard. In her later years, she complained that Emily never visited, that they always had to visit Pittsburgh to see the grandchildren, an accusation Emily disputed bitterly, since it seemed she was always driving to Kersey. Always, never. Their positions were absolute. The old house was a bungalow, and when she and Henry visited, they stayed in Emily's room, the rose-patterned wallpaper untouched since the Depression, the ceilings water-stained, and by the second day, she was ready to leave. How many times did she have to win her freedom, and wasn't it unnatural to feel this way? Because she did love her mother. It was grueling, this confusion. She wished she could express this to Margaret, as if, just by being mothers and daughters, they were all caught in something larger, something ultimately not their fault. She returned to Henry's chair, arranged the afghan over her lap, and pulled the lamp closer so she could work on the puzzle, the bulb warming her. But within minutes, pushed it aside, threw off the afghan, and stood, waking Rufus. He watched her as she passed, headed upstairs, but didn't follow, and she was grateful. For what she was about to do, she needed privacy. She climbed toward the second floor deliberately, head bowed, her eyes on the risers, certain she was making a mistake. Whether she was doing penance or indulging herself, she regularly performed this rite, pawing through her hoard of treasure like a curator, knowing it would change nothing. Like Margaret with chocolate, she couldn't resist. In her room, she ceremoniously faced her dresser. It had been her mother's, salvaged from the old house and expensively refinished. The top drawer was shallow, a repository for baggage tags and travel alarms, shoehorns, passports. Her mother had kept everything, and opening it after her death, Emily had been staggered. Much of the clutter dated from Emily's girlhood. It was here that she found her birth certificate and her silver rattle and her father's wallet. Among these keepsakes, tied like a gift with a yellow ribbon, was a bundle of hand-drawn cards Emily had forgotten making. Browned at the edges, her penciled hearts and flowers and cakes and houses celebrated the unalloyed joy of the only child. Here, in all seasons, were the smiling stick figures under a smiling sun. The first time she'd leafed through them, she'd been abashed at not just her clumsy lettering, but her earnestness. Love, Emily, they closed, over and over, abundant proof of her goodness and innocence. And yet, when she revisited them, as she did now, she felt a strange regret, as if they'd been written by someone else. Her mother hadn't saved any of her other letters, only the program from her college graduation and her wedding announcement. As if in imitation, the other packet Emily removed was fastened with a pink ribbon, Margaret's cards to her, in crayon, but graced by the same wobbly hand and free sentiments. Side by side, they seemed evidence of a mysterious bond, as if she and her mother were destined to share the same fate. "I love you," Margaret had scrawled. Emily lingered over the words, wondering if the feeling behind them still held true after all these years. Or was it just a fossil, a promise, like the child who'd written it, that was gone forever? This was precisely the danger of having too much time to herself. She retied the packet and returned it to its niche, closed the drawer and descended again. She sat with her half-done puzzle, listening to Bach in the rain, fending off unprofitable thoughts, waiting, though she knew better, for the phone to ring. And then, when it finally did, felt relief. "Happy Mother's Day," Margaret said. "Why, thank you, dear. Happy Mother's Day to you, too. I'm not your mother." "And for that," Emily said, "you should be eternally grateful." Thank you. Great. Thank you. Thank you. Other gods. You know, the 17th is usually my lucky day, and it's not today. No. Sure, I could answer, I hope. I can fake it. The brave person in the second row.
"I came because I really loved your book last night at the Lobster.
Thank you.
If you would recommend that I buy just one more book, would you?
Just one more. Last one for life. This is it. I would probably go to Snow Angels, my first novel. I think it shows sort of both sides of me. It's got some good propulsive elements there. It works in first and third. And you're not going through depression, are you? Okay, then yeah, go ahead with Snow Angels then. That's good.
What kind of things do you have to take into consideration when you're writing an older character?
In this case, I thought mostly, well, because she's in the other book and I'd worked with her a lot before, I've had her for a long time, but when I was sort of gearing up to write this book, I thought a lot about her language and what kind of language, what kind of words she would use, basically what her vocabulary was. And I had a whole notebook just filled with words that she would use that I would never use. And you sort of keep your ears open and listen to a lot of people from that age bracket and what they're concerned about. When I was doing research for the Circus Fire, I interviewed hundreds of people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that's kind of, I think, where that first book, Wish You Were Here, came from. That idea of looking back at your life and your family and trying to make sense of things that you did okay and the things that you didn't do well and your regrets and coming to terms with that. And in this case, I wanted to talk about how you get from day to day. It's typical in me. How does it feel to be you? How do you get from day to day? But in this case, how do you live with yourself? Because Emily lives alone, and the only person that she has sustained contact with is Arlene. She doesn't particularly care for Arlene. So how do you live with yourself and everything that you've done? I think. Stephanie Vaughn.
Yeah, how does a guy from Pittsburgh who wears Steelers black and gold end up writing about the Boston Red Sox?
Or could you talk about fiction and baseball?
Fiction and baseball. I don't know if there's a lot to talk about. Robert Coover, Universal Baseball Association, great, great book. I grew up a Pirates fan. I moved to Boston in 1979 when the Pirates, We Are Family team, won the World Series, and I lived like a block away from Fenway Park, and it cost $2 to go to the game, and you could smoke in the stadium. So I would go, and I would sit there and read and smoke in the center field bleachers, and so the game kind of went on around me.
I thought you were going to say Red Hub fans, good kid, adieu.
Oh, no, Mr. Updike's little piece on Ted Williams. No.
Maybe Updike got you into baseball.
No. Updike got me into describing things a little too closely. That's what he got me into, I think. No, in fact, I worked with Updike with Rabbit. Rabbit is Rich, I looked at really hard when I was doing Last Night at the Lobster, in the way that Rabbit's relationship with the Toyota dealership is sort of nailed down. A lot of close work. Really quiet crowd, isn't it?
I have a question. I don't have any experience with writing, so please go ahead and tell me if it's a dumb question. But I'll tell you some of my experience when I'm reading your book, which I find, wish you were here or what you just read, is that I feel almost overwhelmed by this onslaught of trivia, while at the same time interspersed are these transcendental thoughts about life and personal relationships. So when you write, how should I interpret the meaning behind going, standing in front of the dresser, looking at the dresser, taking something out, or going and I don't know, putting the silverware away, starting to cook a steak on the grill, and at the same time, all this stuff that I think is really important is going on in their heads. So how, why? Is there a cadence? Do you have write three sentences of transcendence and then one sentence of you see what I mean? It's confusing for me to read.
Usually I'll add physical detail in there to ground the reader in terms of scene. Although a lot of the stuff takes place in Emily's head in this particular book. I mean, I think there's more scene setting in the other book. But concrete detail is the lifeblood of fiction, right? John Gardner. But what I'm hoping is going to happen is that when I'm describing these things that are common to a lot of people, that the reader will then sort of match their own memories of their own childhood pictures and childhood drawings and those sort of little treasure trove that their parents might have had, or they as parents have, or they as grandparents have, and sort of bring their life into the book and start thinking about their own lives and their own past and their own children and grandchildren and aunts and grandmothers and mothers and fathers. Oh. And that's the hope, is that you bring the reader in and they bring their life in, and there's enough room for them to do that, I think. In a live setting, I don't think it's quite as effective, but sitting and actually reading the book and dropping in there, I'm hoping that's what happens.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you that is what happened to me.
Oh, well, good.
Smashing success.
Good. Well, thank you. Yeah, and working with just sort of common, everyday characters, I think it gives room for people to bring their own lives in, whereas if I were writing, say, Spider-Man, you know, it would be different. Or something like A Prayer for the Dying. There's a little room in there for your psyche, but there's not much room for your history. Okay. Jim.
There was one word, only one word, that bothered me a little bit. And it was the radio was playing Shostakovich, and it mauled?
Mauling, yeah.
Would that fit Emily?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, she's very critical, especially when it comes to music. Super critical, yeah.
So I have no objection.
Yeah, she has very little patience for Mahler, Brahms. I mean, she's definitely sort of a 19th or even 18th century fan. Her idea of perfection is Purcell.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
A lot. last remaining bookstores in Tompkins County have got books and for sale, and then the last, perhaps, paperbacks you'll ever be able to buy around this site.
I'd also like to give a plug for some readings that are coming down the pike here.
Okay.
Alan Lightman on Monday is reading. On Tuesday, 6:30, Buffalo Street Books, John Lennon will be talking about his novel Castle. And next Thursday right here, Nicholson Baker, the amazing Nicholson Baker.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.